Iran criticizes the suspension of its voting rights at the United Nations, blaming Washington's cruel sanctions for the situation. Saudi warplanes conduct new air raids near a hospital in Yemen's Sanhan district, injuring 4 staffers. Also coming up, the US dollar falls to a 2-month low after data show a new 40-year rise in American consumer prices. Thank you for joining us. Our top story this hour, Iran criticizes the suspension of its right to vote at the United Nations, stressing that U.S. sanctions have brought about the situation. Foreign Ministry spokesman Saeed Khatibzadeh says Iran is a founding and active member of the UN and considers itself duty-bound to fully and timely pay its membership fee. Khatibzadeh stresses that Tehran has prepared the fees and is conducting necessary consultations to resolve the issue. He has also urged the UN to take the situation of sanctions-stricken countries into account. Iran has been denied the right to vote at the UN General Assembly after failing to pay its membership dues because of the sanctions. Political commentator Keaton Mansfield says the United Nations needs to stand against Washington's pressure against other countries.
Well, you know, Iran has been a member with the United Nations since its formation after World War II. And the UN is supposed to be an impartial international organization where all countries meet in a central location to address global political matters on a level playing field, where every person's vote, regardless of how powerful or how wealthy a country is, each vote should be worth the same amount. And so, because of the sanctions that the U.S. and international global financial institutions, the IMF, the World Bank, have levied against Iran, it's made it very difficult for the government to pay its UN dues. And so if the UN isn't going to seriously take action to have the U.S. remove these sanctions, then the UN also can't pretend or claim that Iran has to listen to the UN. If Iran doesn't get a vote at the United Nations, then they can't be expected to be held accountable to the United Nations. And so I think it's a bigger issue of the UN needs to kind of buck up and stand up against the U.S. and the pressure that the U.S. has put on the UN General Assembly as a whole and the Security Council.
Talks between Iran and the remaining signatories to the 2015 deal are underway in the Austrian capital in a bid to revive the agreement. Our Vienna-based correspondent Homolezki says there are some positive signs that the negotiations are moving forward. Here is what she has to say.
Today we heard that the third working group on implementation arrangements or sequencing, also known as sequencing, between Iran and the remaining signatories of the JCPOA has also convened, which could be seen as a sign that progress is indeed being made, because up until this stage, sources were saying that the sides were not yet in a stage or ready to discuss this sequencing or implementation issues. The fact that this working group has met today on this issue is indeed itself a positive sign. And this, of course, when we're talking about implementation, we mean which actions need to be taken at what stages, or that's what we mean by sequencing. The other two working groups, one is focused on sanctions removal and the other on the nuclear commitments of Iran. We also had, as you say, meetings today between the head of Iran's delegation, Mr. Barzani Kani, and the Europeans and the EU coordinator, and a meeting that was held between Russia and the U.S. envoy, Rob Malley, and that meeting was described by Mikhail Ulyanov, the Russian delegate, as positive. And he also said that there's a feeling that the talks are moving forward. Also positive signals coming from the Russian deputy foreign minister, Mr. Ryabkov, earlier he was saying that the talks are gaining momentum. So we are hearing some positive signs there, although the French foreign minister said this doesn't mean we are near an agreement. He was insisting yet that we are still far from a deal, although he did acknowledge that things are moving forward. The Europeans have been quite adamant in their position that time is running out, and some Iranian sources have said that this is meant to put pressure on the Iranians or to try and gain concessions during these talks. Another source close to the Iranian negotiating team was saying yesterday that there have been certain attempts to, for instance, introduce new demands into the talks or to revise the understandings that have already been reached within the context of the talks to restore the JCPOA, without going into further details of what those demands could be.
We're going to turn to some breaking news now. Saudi Arabia pushing ahead with its deadly campaign of airstrikes on Yemeni cities. The Saudi-led coalition's warplanes have conducted two air raids on the vicinity of a hospital in the Sanhan district in Sana'a province. Local media say four hospital staffers have been injured. Two of them are in critical condition. Saudi Arabia launched a devastating war on its southern neighbor in 2015 to reinstate a friendly government there. That objective has not been achieved, but hundreds of thousands of Yemenis have been killed in the conflict. Turning elsewhere, an event has been held in Lebanon to mark 6 years since the execution of Shia cleric Sheikh Nimr Baqir al-Nimr by Saudi Arabia. Mariam Saleh reports from the Lebanese capital, Beirut.
On the 6th anniversary of the martyrdom of prominent Shia cleric Sheikh Nimr Baqir al-Nimr, who was executed by the Saudi regime, a group formed at the initiation of a union of opposition members in the Arab Peninsula held its first meeting in the Lebanese capital, Beirut. Dr. Fouad Ibrahim, a Saudi opposition academic, stressed that this is a platform for a new political organization.
This occasion could be considered as a platform for a new political organization that will start to build up a political discourse and political agenda in the coming days. And it's just a starting point for a group that has been working for a long time but without political identity.
In an address to the event, head of Hezbollah's executive council, Sayyid Hashem Safiyuddin, stressed that no power in the world can stand in the face of the voices which support the oppressed and the victims of unjust rule of the Saudi family.
One thing is clear, Saudi Arabia needs to stop the policy of bullying other Arab and Islamic states. They spend lots of money against the interest of the people of the Arab Peninsula. The money is spent to hatch further conspiracies against Palestine and Al-Quds. Saudi Arabia and its allies have failed to achieve their goals in the region.
Sayyid Safiyuddin also demanded that the Saudi regime stop pumping money only to sow discord and sedition in Lebanon and across the Arab world. The Yemeni nationals at the meeting stressed that it is the time to tell the Saudis that enough is enough.
The blood of 500,000 martyrs that was shed in Yemen encourages us to do whatever in our power to liberate Mecca and Medina and get rid of Saudi rulers. We had been under Saudi aggression for 70 years, but Imam Khomeini and his support gave us the courage to stand against our enemy.
The problem of the region, the participants say, is not merely an issue of unemployment or lack of services for certain communities in the Arab Peninsula, but rather the presence of a state which meddles in other states' affairs. The Muslim clerics believe the Wahhabi ideology of the Saudi rulers is not only persecuting the people of other sects, but is also distorting the true image of Islam by spreading false ideologies. Analysts believe there is a growing conviction that the tyranny of the Saudi regime will lead to a downfall, while the people of the Persian Gulf Arab states who have endured persecution will one day find their way towards self-rule and freedom. Mariam Saleh, Beirut.
That's Elsewhere, Iran's Minister of Roads and Urban Development has paid a three-day visit to the Syrian capital, Damascus, for talks on mutual ties. Heading an economic and political delegation, Rostam Qasemi met with the Syrian President Bashar al-Assad to discuss issues of bilateral interest. Our correspondent Muhammad Ali has more in this report.
Syrian President Bashar al-Assad met Iranian Minister of Roads and Urban Development Rostam Qasemi. During the meeting, the two sides discussed means of expanding bilateral cooperation in public and private sectors, as well as encouraging further joint investments. Assad underlined the importance of starting new projects that achieve strategic and joint benefits for the two states and link business sectors in Syria and Iran. Qasemi, for his part, renewed his country's support to Syria in fighting terrorism and assisting the Syrian people. The Iranian official also met with Syria's Foreign Minister Faisal al-Miqdad. They asserted determination to reach a significant level of trade exchange and economic partnerships.
I met today with President Assad. We discussed economic topics and agreed on forming a joint committee to remove all obstacles on the way of expansion of mutual ties. I also met with Syria's foreign minister. We agreed to set a plan for developing economic relations between the two countries and regional states.
We discussed economic relations. Nothing at all can block expansion of our economic relations. We discussed partnerships in the transport sector. Syria is interested in heading eastwards, as President Assad stressed back in 2005.
Qasemi also met with his Syrian counterpart and reached agreements on consolidating cooperation in the transport sector. The Iranian delegation's visit aims to further activate economic ties, mainly in the transport sector, increase the number of flights between both countries, as well as the bulk of trade exchange.
Qasemi's visit comes following a similar one by Iran's Minister of Trade, Industry and Mine less than 2 months ago. Talks recently between both countries' officials have focused on establishing partnerships with the aim of boosting their economies together to counter economic sanctions imposed by their enemies. Muhammad Ali, Damascus.
The US dollar slumps to a two-month low as the country is experiencing its biggest annual inflation jump in nearly four decades. The US dollar currency index, which tracks the greenback against six major currencies, was down 0.7% at 94.944. A Federal Reserve official says the US inflation is too high and that the central bank will make the issue a priority. Meanwhile, the Labor Department is reporting that the Consumer Price Index surged at a 7% year-on-year pace in December. Economists believe the rate will likely to reach a peak by March. The U.S. is also grappling with disruption to its supply chain that has been worsened by a surge in COVID cases. David Barkin is a professor of economics at the Metropolitan Autonomous University and joins us now out of Mexico City. Professor, welcome. What's your thoughts on this? Is this down to inflation hitting a 40-year high, which is in line with widespread expectations, or are there other factors at play here?
I think that there are other factors at play that are very, very important. I think that there's a structural change in the U.S. Labor force, which is directly affecting the economy. The labor force has seen itself greatly strengthened in its ability to negotiate with employers, and wage rates are substantially rising for those people who are in the labor market. And that's particularly important because that is probably going to change the nature of the labor employer relationships over the next few years. And that is going to further heighten inflationary pressures. But the inflationary pressures, unfortunately, are going to affect a country which is increasingly divided, in which you have large proportions of the population that are experiencing homelessness, are experiencing various kinds of economic problems and social and political problems that are a result of the intractable political stalemate that the United States is presently facing in the Congress. So if you add all these things up together, your initial description of an as an economist reading what the Federal Reserve Bank of is saying, I think understates the nature of the profound schisms that are existing in the United States society now, much more than the simple disruptions that are a result of energy costs and supply chain breakdowns.
Interesting aspects, interesting stuff. David Barkin, Professor of Economics, thank you very much indeed for your contribution. Professor Barkin is from the Metropolitan Autonomous University, joining us live out of Mexico City. Now, 1 year into the storming of the U.S. Capitol by supporters of former President Donald Trump, a new poll shows a majority of Americans believe the country's democracy is in danger of collapse. The study, conducted by the Quinnipiac University, says 76% of Americans think political instability in the U.S. is a bigger danger than foreign threats. Over half of them also expect domestic political divisions to worsen. The poll comes as a special committee of the House of Representatives is investigating last year's deadly insurrection. The storming was meant to overturn Trump's defeat in the 2020 presidential election. Now, most of those surveyed say they support the investigation. Well, that brings an end to our bulletin for this hour. Thank you for staying tuned.
This is IRIB English Radio. With you early in the morning. With you at midday. With you till the night's end. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Lab studies hint that a longer interval between vaccination and infection is better than a shorter one, says Saimaa May Siddique, writer, in an article published under the heading Immunity Against Omicron from Breakthrough Infection Could Be a Matter of Timing. Stay tuned for more. Timing is a key to success, even for riding out the Omicron wave. Research from Japan suggests that COVID-19 vaccination followed months later by a breakthrough SARS-CoV-2 infection offers greater protection against the Omicron variant than do closely spaced vaccination and infection. The finding implies that countries that saw large numbers of non-Omicron infections in late 2021 have an advantage as 2022 rolls in with the new variant. The study has not yet been peer-reviewed. Many countries' populations have gained immunity through a combination of vaccination and infection with an array of variants. But Japan's population is protected mainly by vaccination with mRNA vaccines. Study co-author Takeshi Arashiro, an infectious disease researcher at Japan's National Institute of Infectious Diseases in Tokyo, and his colleagues wanted to understand whether the country's mostly single-source immunity would leave the population especially susceptible to Omicron. So far, the country has had few breakthrough cases, but we are afraid that once the Omicron variant is in high transmission in Japan, we might see a whole different picture, Arashiro says. The team collected antibodies from people in Japan who had received two doses of COVID-19 vaccine and later been infected with either the Alpha or Delta variant. The researchers tested these antibodies' ability to protect cultured cells from SARS-CoV-2 infection and found that the length of time between a person's vaccination and a breakthrough infection was strongly correlated with how well the individual's antibodies protected cells against infection, particularly with Omicron. It's an interesting study, says immunologist Gina Gottmiller at the University of Chicago in Illinois. She cautions that the results are solely correlative, but adds that they are in line with immunologists' general understanding of how antibody responses mature over time. Gottmiller explains that vaccination leads to an emergency blast of antibody production as a natural infection would. If a person gets infected soon after vaccination, these antibodies are probably still circulating in the blood, where they will bind to the virus and quickly eliminate it. But when a person becomes infected months after vaccination, the antibodies that respond come from a new and improved batch made by long-lived cells that carry a memory of the pathogen. When the body encounters the pathogen again, these memory cells are called back to duty and have a chance to refine the antibodies, providing better protection against subsequent infections. Gottmiller says she would like to see similar data focused on vaccine boosters instead of breakthrough infections. Does the amount of time between your first two doses and then your booster impact how many cross-reactive antibodies you have? She asks. Arashiro and his colleagues have not investigated that, but he thinks boosters are still Japan's best bet for combating the Omicron wave. We're trying to push for booster doses as soon as possible, especially among vulnerable populations, because we're only protected by vaccines, not by natural infections, he says.
Food for thought.
Hello everyone, and here is what Hazrat Fatima Zahra, peace be upon her, told Muslims after the passing away of her dear father, the Almighty's last messenger, when she perceived signs of weakness of faith among them. When God perceived the nations divided into different religions, deifying fire and worshipping idols, and rejecting Him in spite of their intellect and knowledge, God the Majestic guided and enlightened them from darkness through my father, Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, and removed the curtains of ignorance from their hearts and illuminated their eyes, relieving them from blindness.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, challenges of a family life. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In today's lesson, we will talk about the challenges of a family life. When we look at the family and the structure of the family, generally what we can see in the society is that people do not marry, they do not form a family. Why? Because they are not ready to cope with the challenges that they will face. And therefore, when they see the challenges in the family, when they see the responsibility and take being responsible for someone else, they run away from a bound which is known as marriage, and therefore they do not form a family. Even if two couples, they marry each other, they don't bring kids, they do not want to have children or kids. Why? Because the raising kids is a big challenge. They think it's a big challenge for them, and therefore for these difficulties, which they think are the difficulties, they think that they should not go for having children, or maybe they should not marry, even for those who are unmarried, who are single. But these things are not right, because this is something which has been injected through the Western society, through non-Islamic society, through the society which do not believe in God, which have no belief in God, which do not know how to manage a family. But Islam teaches us how to do this, inshallah. Welcome back. You're listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. We were talking about the challenges in the Islamic lifestyle. And we said generally people do not marry because they think of challenges of raising kids, or maybe having responsibility of someone else when you get married. For example, husband is responsible for the wife, or it's vice versa. So they do not marry. Whereas when they look at the bound, they only see, unfortunately, a sexual relation, which they think that they can deal this relation with having the non or unlawful relation with someone else, especially in the non-Islamic society, where there is the the people can have, the boys can have girlfriends and the girlfriends can have boyfriends without having any bound, without being responsible of each other, in order to just have their lusts or to enjoy the life, they are choosing such thing. Islam is against this. In the Islamic lifestyle, the first thing is that if you are a man, be a man, take responsibility of your wife. If you are a woman, be a woman and take responsibility of your husband. And once we are the responsible people in this society, we need to show this kind of responsibility, or we need to show that we are responsible people, we are reasonable people, by having a lawful relation which is known as marriage, and to form family in order to show such responsibility. Inshallah, may Allah give us tawfiq to follow the right path, inshallah. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thanks for listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/en/call-of-islam page. Till another episode, God bless you all. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Cultural news, social news, scientific news, artistic news. With delight.
South Koreans enjoy a wildlife refuge near the Korean Demilitarized Zone. New tours opened in November from the DMZ Crane Peace Town. Frank Smith has more in this report.
A new hiking trail and birdwatching facility opened up in South Korea this past November. DMZ Crane Peace Town created special birding cabins and guides wilderness hikes north of the 38th parallel, near the DMZ, the fortified border with North Korea.
The Demilitarized Zone was created with the armistice that ended the Korean War back in 1953. Guard post fencing and a 2 to 4 kilometer wide buffer zone now separate North Korea and South Korea, with that no man's land becoming home to rejuvenated plant and wildlife.
Local officials see wildlife tourism as an opportunity to promote inter-Korean peace.
Cranes know no borders. That's why we're promoting the crane as a symbol of peace, as they can freely come and go between North and South Korea.
Each winter, several species of birds, especially cranes, spend time to rest and feed in the area, where there's little development and few people. Officials say more birds have been coming here because of depleted feeding grounds in the north.
Sichuan has wide plains suitable for growing rice. Cranes eat the grain that has fallen after harvest, and it's the best place for cranes because it's located north of the civilian control line.
A safe vantage point to photograph the wildlife is provided at the Hantan River near Yangji Village, attracting birders from far afield.
I left home at 4 in the morning to come here to photograph wild birds, swans and cranes. It's good because there are many mallard ducks and other birds. They fight for food with each other, but it's fun.
Cranes are considered a sacred symbol of longevity and fortune here and designated a national monument. Frank Smith, Cheongwon County, South Korea.
Thirty-three lucky green sea turtles get a new lease on life in Indonesia. The turtles were released into the sea off the coast of the island of Bali. Tourists and locals gathered to watch the endangered animals get their way back to the wild. Authorities rescued the reptiles from poachers late last year. The population of green sea turtles has fell sharply in recent years due to excessive hunting and the loss of nesting sites. In Chile, three Andean condors are back in the wild after years of rehab at a rescue center. The vulnerable vultures were released near the Chilean capital, Santiago. Scientists will continue to monitor the birds to make sure they are healthy. Andean condors occupy a special place in Chile. They are, in fact, the country's national bird and a symbol of power and health. The vultures are one of the biggest flight-capable birds in the world, with a wingspan of up to 3.2 meters. Conservationists in several countries are trying to shore up their population.
In Germany, tasty bits of crumbs are all it takes for hundreds of sheep and goats to participate in the campaign to encourage vaccination against COVID-19. 700 farm animals were arranged into a 100-meter-long syringe in a pasture south of Hamburg. The shepherd says she spent several days practicing the herd. The sheep and goats were lured by pieces of bread, which they quickly gobbled up after being released into the field. Helping the shepherd was an organizer who works with a flock to run team training exercises for companies. He says they wanted to do something to grab people's attention and encourage them to get COVID jabs.
Well, if I were to just write it on Facebook, nobody would notice it. And my job is to have company teams leading some thousand sheep from A to B, and I have noticed how enthusiastically the sheep are received, and that it simply reaches people deep inside, which is perhaps not possible rationally, with rational arguments.
Etzold says sheep bring out the soft side of people and hopes that this will help convey the message. So far, the campaign has received a positive response, with videos of the sheep arrangement going viral. Official data shows Germany has the lowest inoculation rate among Western European nations. This is mainly attributed to vaccination hesitancy, as well as a small percentage who vehemently oppose getting the jab. Technological change is accelerating today, with robots and artificial intelligence making fast inroads into human lives. A consumer electronics show in Las Vegas is the latest example of the same. From lifelike baby dolls to full-grown human-like robots are on the display. They not only write, cry, laugh, and blink, but some of them speak and react when you tell them something. The most interesting thing about these robots is their reactions, which are just like humans, seeming as if they are real people. The robot makers say soon people will not be scared of these human-faced machines being among them.
Humans are so complex, so making a robot exactly like a human is almost impossible. If we did that, then you wouldn't be scared of it, because you'd just assume it's a human. But you get that uncanny valley just before, where it doesn't quite move like a human, doesn't quite express itself or emote or talk like a human. And that's the uncanny valley. That's the scary bit. If you go further back to something that looks less like a human, then suddenly you like it a lot more.
The robot makers hope that the way these robots are made would help even doctors how to treat and confront children, for instance. They also hope that by adding more human characteristics to these robots, the machines will be at the service of humans more than before.
The Light is a bulletin in which we bring you a lot of interesting news in different fields, like animals' life, cultural events, funny trending news, and more from every corner of the world.
Let's see what's happening in one of the world's oldest festivals. It's called Black and White Carnival, celebrated every year in the Colombian city of Pasto. But it has a lot more than what its name may suggest. The carnival, full of vibrant colors and fun, livens up when people perform music too. Those in attendance even threw talcum powder and foam to add more doses of joy. More things to visit too. Colorful monuments and floats are brought to the streets. An artisan explains what's behind one of the huge sculptures exhibited there.
This commemorates what we are going through right now in the world, the virus, that little thing that brought COVID. We have skulls, people who died, those who are reborn, children, old people, and a lady. That's the whole motif. It's called rebirth.
The event has roots in Spanish and African traditions related to the indigenous people of Colombia. The carnival is aimed at highlighting the diversity of ethnic and cultural backgrounds. Its name symbolizes unity and equality. The festival continues until January the 10th. A zoo in the Netherlands is celebrating the birth of a newborn manatee, a rare event among the endangered species, especially within the confines of captivity. The newcomer was born in a Royal Burger Zoo in a Dutch city of Arnhem. Zookeepers say the birth went smoothly, adding that this is the mother's second calf. The newborn is still too young for keepers to be able to determine its gender, but handlers hope it will be a female. That's because there are only 15 females in European zoos. Manatees are closely related to elephants and are sometimes called sea cows because of their herbivorous diet. These gentle giants are listed as vulnerable to extinction mainly because of loss of habitat and collisions with boats. Shanghai is one of the most famous cities in the world, boasting an impressive number of tourist attractions. Now, the city is host to a new event that could draw excited visitors. The exhibition includes more than 100 items from Egypt, including 6 golden mummies. The most prized object on display is a 20-year-old female mummy with a gold mask and 2 jewels for eyes. Organizers have also put up for show original works by great European artists such as Raphael and Pablo Picasso.
Chinese astronauts on board the space station have held a unique conference with students, sending them a message that sky is the limit. They hope to inspire students to pursue their dreams and be proactive about their goals. Let's have a listen.
Every one of us went through rigorous selection and arduous training before carrying out space missions. Many people have to wait for several years, dozens of years, and even a whole life. But what deserves praise is that we have never given up, but remain true to our original aspiration, stood the loneliness, and passed the tests.
Ye, who is a first-time space traveler, also encouraged students to be brave in following their dreams. The Chinese astronauts talked about their life, work, and personal experiences. Students from Beijing, Hong Kong, and Macau were given the rare chance to ask their own questions during the Ground Space Conference. China launched Shenzhou 13 into space in October last year. The astronauts are scheduled to stay in orbit for 6 months, which will be the country's longest ever crewed mission.
The mobile public library is back in the Afghan capital, Kabul, to bring joy to children with exciting books and games. The library reaches hundreds of children on a daily basis, seeking to expand its coverage in the coming days. Rahmatullah Baghban has more.
As the sun rises in Kabul, the Charmagh's mobile library starts a fresh mission to delight children. The library goes from zone to zone in the capital, Kabul, to spread the joy and love of reading among the Afghan children. It operates in 5 buses and has a children-friendly space. The organizers say they are happy being back for Afghan children.
Definitely, we want to enhance reading among children and boost their creative thinking. We have 5 mobile libraries operating across Kabul. Our services were shut for 3 months due to government change, but now they're happy that once again they can reach Kabul children. The library was sponsored by Afghan traders, but now it's out of funds and needs economic support.
I love my job here as a librarian. It's free for all. Children from different backgrounds come here to read books and play games. What I love most is watching children smiling and having fun with each other. I'm proud I can serve them with the skill I have.
Children are highly excited as they find the library right in front of their houses. Hundreds of children make daily use of initiative, as most schools in Kabul lack library.
Mama,
the mobile library used to come to our alley every week, but over the past 3 months, it didn't come, and we missed it so much. We are very happy that it is bringing us joy again. Nowadays that our schools are closed, we can make use of its books.
We thank Charmax for its services. We have learned to read stories, play games, and draw pictures. We have kind teachers and have a good time with our friends.
This creative reading campaign results as the country faced many challenges, affecting children's schooling and taking reading opportunities from them. As schools remain closed for most Afghan children, such services can be a good haven for students and book lovers. The initiative can also encourage children and bring the reading to life. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
People in the northeastern Chinese province are trying to keep alive a winter tradition going back centuries. Each year, local fishermen and women in Jilin use an ancient technique to catch fish from Chagan Lake that is sealed with a thick layer of ice. What these locals do is they drill holes through the ice and put their nets under the holes to catch fish. But to pull out those nets from the lake, they will need help from a bunch of horses.
It was my first time seeing such a scene. Five horses drawing a turntable to gradually pull the net up to the ice surface. I felt very novel to witness this.
The technique has been listed as a cultural heritage in China. The ceremony attracts a large number of local tourists during the fishing season, which lasts until the end of February.
Swimming in sub-zero temperatures can be unimaginable for most people, but not for a group of athletes who've tested their skills and strength in Prague's Vltava River. 360 people from eight countries gathered in the Czech capital to participate in an annual winter swimming event. The air temperature was minus 6 degrees Celsius, with water temperatures dipping to as low as 3 degrees. The event honors Alfred Nikodem, a Czech swimmer who braved the frigid waters in Prague for the first time in 1923, starting a tradition that has been kept alive ever since.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
in the limelight.
Cheney championed the use of torture by the U.S. government and never recanted. Deliberate in-your-face disregard for international human rights laws and norms has become a signature of the GOP. Cheney honed it to a fine art, says Juan Cole, a writer, in an article published under the heading, Dick Cheney paved the way for Trump and the Capitol insurrection. Stay tuned for more. Former Vice President Dick Cheney accompanied his daughter, Representative Liz Cheney, to the Capitol to join the moment of silence in commemoration of the January 6th insurrection. They were the only Republicans to attend. The elder Cheney was quoted as saying of the Republican House leadership, "It's not leadership that resembles any of the folks I knew when I was here for 10 years." He released a statement saying, "I am deeply disappointed at the failure of many members of my party to recognize the grave nature of the January 6 attacks and the ongoing threat to our nation." Dick Cheney was there to give support to his daughter and to slap Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy around for his support of Donald Trump. Dick Cheney was seen talking to Nancy Pelosi and other representatives. Except for Liz, all the others at the ceremony were Democrats. But when we saw Dick Cheney's remark that it's not leadership that resembles any of the folks I knew when I was here for 10 years, we knew that. We would have to be churlish, after all. The remark reminded many of what Jeffrey Goldberg wrote for The New Yorker in 2005 about former National Security Advisor Brent Scowcroft, who served in the Bush senior administration with Cheney and who had advised against launching a war on Iraq. Scowcroft feared that Cheney had gotten himself surrounded by blinkered hawks like Princeton University professor Bernard Lewis. Bernard Lewis says, "I believe that one of the things you've got to do is hit them between the eyes with a big stick. They respect power." Cheney in particular, Scowcroft thinks, accepted Lewis' view of Middle East politics. "The real anomaly in the administration is Cheney," Scowcroft, "for 30 years, but Dick Cheney, I don't know anymore." Dick Cheney, I don't know anymore. That was 2005. Now Dick Cheney says he doesn't know the House Republican Party anymore. Where will this ratcheting of unrecognizability end up? The Republicans are going farther right every decade, such that the previous decade's leaders no longer know them. At this rate, they will be Attila the Hun sacking what's left of civilization by 2030. So here comes the churlish part. Dick Cheney paved the way for Trump and the Capitol insurrection. Cheney championed the use of torture by U.S. government and never recanted. Deliberate, in-your-face disregard for international human rights laws and norms has become a signature of the GOP. Cheney honed it to a fine art. Cheney attacked Colin Powell, questioning his credentials as a Republican, and promoted Rush Limbaugh as the leader of the party. Then Rush Limbaugh turned into the tip of the spear for the presidency of Donald Trump. Limbaugh compared the Capitol insurrection to the American Revolution. Cheney promoted Rush. "This is what happens when you push the country into the arms of far-right dittohouse." As for Cheney's view of Powell,
that black and white view of the world, so that the first black Republican Secretary of State is excommunicated for not being right-wing enough is very Trumpian. Colin Powell got tired of being kicked out, so during the Trump years, he declared himself no longer a Republican. Now it is Liz Cheney, whose party credentials the other Republicans are questioning. Can Dick Cheney see how he personally paved the way for this situation? Today's lie is that Trump won the 2020 election. The big lie in 2002 was that Iraq was fairly close to having a nuclear weapon. The author of that big lie? Dick Cheney. When you get a party used to swallowing blatant falsehoods, eventually it will lose its grip on reality. Dick Cheney started the GOP down that road. So good for him that he stood with his daughter and with Nancy Pelosi to condemn the Trump conspiracy against America, but is part of a longer running such conspiracy that he had never renounced or apologized for, which makes his stand ring a little hollow. Midstream.
Iraqis are still skeptical that the U.S. withdrawal from their country will be a real one. Who's to blame them when the first announced official date of the long goodbye was supposedly August 2021, as per the Trump administration? However, the deadline was simply ignored by the new Biden administration. In July, U.S. President Joe Biden and Iraq's Prime Minister Mustafa al-Qadhimi met in Washington and allegedly agreed to conclude the American combat mission in Iraq by December 31, 2021. That's 3 days from now. Really? They are just going to simply leave? Well, follow me a little. Let us see how the U.S. operates in Iraq to begin with. It is no secret that the U.S. had adopted a low-cost colonial system of ruling Iraq for almost 10 years now. U.S. warplanes were stationed at up to six former Iraqi air bases, becoming the principal enforcer of the occupation. U.S. troops were thinned out. By 2020, this job was done so skillfully that the U.S. presence in Iraq became almost invisible. Hold on, I said almost. Iraq was occupied by Western forces, but it looked like an independent nation with the U.S. installed president and executive branch. Kurdish areas in the north became virtual U.S.-run mini-states. The demented Daesh movement was totally stamped out by Iraqi Hashd al-Shaabi and the Islamic Revolution Guard Corps. As a thank you, the Iranian military supremo in Iraq, Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani, commander of the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps al-Quds forces, was ordered murdered by President Trump. Deputy head of the Iraqi Hashd al-Shaabi, Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis, arose a martyr that day alongside his dear friend and comrade, Martyr Hajj Qasem Soleimani. This grave mistake turned the golden victory in Iraq promised by the American neocons into ashes, leaving Washington stuck deep in an ungovernable nation, yet still capable of defeating Daesh and then targeting its real enemy, the U.S. occupation forces scattered in Iraq. Faced by the threat of more resistance guerrilla warfare, Joe Biden's administration announced it would pull all remaining